no helicopters have been procured for me to go to golf course. Thank you.
I've never said he wasn't a great politician. I'm just saying he's a officer.
Trust me,
how'd you play out there today?
Well, I found the conditions challenging, mostly because there's no grass on the golf course, but there never has been.
I'm thinking about the swag bag, and I hug the swag bag.
When you got three crevices on the green, your course is trash.
What is going on, folks? Welcome back to the Beltway Golfer Podcast. This is episode 77. I am your host, Alex Dixon. This is going to be the last podcast episode of the year. Slowed down a little bit this year. Didn't put out quite as many as 2022, but did a lot. Got into other stuff. Got really into shooting drones. If you're not following us on Instagram or social media, give us a follow at Beltway Golfer and see some of our drone footage. Gotten into it and having a lot of great feedback. But going to put out a lot more podcasts. Got a great list of guests that we're working on for 2024. So excited about that. But the golf season doesn't stop. And we've got an exciting one because just this past week was PGA Tour Q School, which for the first time in a decade or so, they were actually giving out PGA Tour cards. This year's Q School was top five in ties, adds a whole nother level of pressure that they haven't had in many, many years. It used to be that's what Q School was all about. I mean, go read John Feinstein's book, Tales from Q School. It really paints a great picture of just the amount of pressure and intensity that there's just so much on the line for these guys that have worked their whole lives to try to get to this moment. And it all comes down to one weekend to try to get their PGA Tour card. So that was taken away for I don't have the number of years, but at least a decade or so. And this year they brought that back in along with all sorts of different levels of status on the Korn Ferry Tour, depending on where you finish. Our guest today is Davis Lamb. I've had my eye on Davis for a while. We follow each other on social media for quite some time. But earlier this summer, he won not once, but twice back-to-back events on PGA Tour Canada, which got him into to finish top three or at least top five, I think he said, in the PGA Tour Canada standings, which in turn got him into this final stage of Q School. So followed him this past weekend, and he was gracious enough to hop on almost immediately after Q School ended. And he was great. It was great to learn about just kind of what he went through at Q School, his year in PGA Tour Canada, what his year looks like coming up with some status on the Korn Ferry Tour, and just growing up as a golfer. In the DMV, played at Georgetown Prep. He's a congressional guy. He's was All-Met Player of the Year his senior year at Georgetown Prep. He won the Maryland State Open. We get into all of it. And he was a great guest and really learned a lot and got a kind of a picture of what it's like, you know, grinding out there on some of these tours, trying to get to that level where you have a PGA Tour card. Davis is still a young guy, so he's probably one of the younger guys that was in Q School, but you know, I seems to have a bright career and had a great year. So wish him all the best on the Korn Ferry Tour coming up here in 2024. Before we get to the conversation with Davis, well, I was about to do our sponsor read and I just pulled up their website and it appears Union Green might be done. I don't know. Their website is not working. I'm going to have to reach out. But if Union Green is still in business, then they're sponsoring this podcast because they've paid for the sponsorship. But uniongreen.com does not seem to be working. Anyway, let's just get to the podcast. Happy holidays, everybody. I hope everyone had a fantastic 2023. Can't wait for 2024. Let's get out and play. Here's Davis Lamb, DMV golfer, going to be out on the Korn Ferry Tour in 2024, as well as the PGA Tour Americas. Hope you enjoy episode 77 of the Beltway Golfer Podcast. Here he is. So we're hanging out with Davis Lamb. Davis, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
So you just told me, why don't you tell the listeners where are you at right now?
I am down in Jupiter, Florida. I've been here for a couple of years now. And after this week, I'm taking a much needed off day. It's a little cloudy and windy today, so it's a good day to take a break.
So we're only 2 days removed from final stage of Q School. So let me start by saying thank you for being open to hopping on such short notice, especially after what I can only imagine is about as stress-filled a golf weekend or golf tournament that you've maybe ever played. I don't know. You tell me. But why don't you just start off by saying, what was the whole weekend like? What are your takeaways? What was the experience like?
It was a lot of fun. It was my first time at Final Stage, and I'm not sure how familiar you are with the new format. In prior years, I want to say the last 20 years, Q School has only been to get to the Korn Ferry Tour. So it's made up of, you know, 150 to 180 guys who went through Q School or got exempt in some way or another. And this year, because there were five tour cards on the line for the top five plus ties, if it came to that, there were a ton of guys outside the top 125 on tour. Pretty much the entire Korn Ferry Tour outside the top 30 was there. So as far as strength of field goes, I'd never really seen anything like it. You know, guys that had a tougher year than you're used to were there playing in the same golf tournament I was. So it was a lot of fun. I had the benefit this year of already having guaranteed starts in the Korn Ferry going into it. So as far as stress goes, obviously it's still very high, but not as bad as it is for some others. I mean, every shot when you go to that tournament matters. Even if you're not in the top 45, not getting guaranteed starts, every shot from that point on just helps your category and helps you improve going to the next year.
So I got like all kinds of questions to ask about, so this was your first time there. So let's just back up a second before Q School. So you just mentioned you had already earned some status on and some starts on the Korn Ferry due to not one, but two wins and a top three finish, up at PGA Tour Canada. And they refer to their end of season standings. I'm a little confused by this myself. What is the Fortinet Cup? Is that the year-long standings or is that like the end of season tournament?
Both. It's a little bit confusing. So it's the Fortinet Cup is the PGA Tour Canada version of the FedEx Cup. Right. So it's just a points list throughout the whole year through all 10 events. And then the season ending points list is called the Race of the Fortinet Cup. And the final event of the year, the top 60 players on the tour go to the Fortinet Cup Championship. So it's two separate tournaments, if you will. But the most important one is the points list for the whole year.
So you finished in the top three. Is that what got you status or was it the wins that you got early in the summer?
It was. Well, so the wins contributed to my finish. But
right.
Top five this year from the PGA Tour Canada were guaranteed Korn Ferry status. The number one, Hayden, who just got his tour card, he got full status for the year. Me and the other guy who finished second and third, Sam Choi and I, got the first four starts guaranteed and a spot in Final Stage. And then fourth and fifth get into Final Stage, and they're in what's called the zipper category, which is the same category as the guys from the Korn Ferry previous year that finished 75th to 100th. So they're guaranteed status, but not guaranteed any starts.
Got it. So you already had some starts, you know, even like as someone who like coming, I mean, not that I'm like the closest follower to this stuff, but I was trying to follow it and like getting information off the internet on like trying to figure out some stuff. And it's challenging trying to figure out who to follow to figure out, okay, if this person finishes in the top five, top 40, top 30, next 30, you know, what they mm-hmm. get. So were you, I mean, I imagine you're well aware, like, as far as I understood, obviously top five and ties got their PGA Tour cards. And then the next 30 got a guaranteed eight starts on the Korn Ferry. Is that right?
So the next 20 out of that top five get the first 12, and then the top 40. So the next 20 after that get the first eight.
Got it. So coming out of it, did you gain any additional starts or status based on your performance?
So, like you said, it's a little bit confusing. Even I'm not entirely sure. Cause I'm in one category through Canada and I missed top 45 by a shot. So I'm not guaranteed eight, but that puts me in a slightly better category in terms of alternate positions go for the rest of the year. But yeah. To answer your question, it depends so much on who plays each week, which guys decide to play Korn Ferry, which guys decide to stay in their conditional PGA Tour stuff. So there's really no, it's not as cut and dry as you might wish it was. I have the first four. I know that. I know if I play well in those, everything takes care of itself. So I'm trying not to worry about really anything else.
Yeah, I imagine that's got to be challenging while you're playing. Cause like you said, this is, you know, one of the deepest, if the deepest field of, in a golf tournament that you've ever participated in. And it's all, you know, you missed this next level of starts or status by one stroke. Like, is it a challenge in the moment, especially in your fourth round that got delayed till Monday? Like, were you fully aware that you needed that extra shot the entire time? Or are you trying to block that out and just play your game?
You know, you block it out, but they've got a lot of big leaderboards out there, so it's pretty hard to not focus on it. You know, conditions were tough all week, and particularly on the Monday, it was very windy and pretty cold. So I was four or five shots outside of that number going into the day. So I knew I needed to play a great round. I wasn't going out there trying to press anything. You know, it wasn't like a Monday. It's to still want to just put a good round together and see what happens. I ended up shooting two under and thought I would have been outside by two or three, and it ended up being one. And that's just kind of how it goes. I wouldn't say I was letting off the gas coming down the stretch. There's some tough holes coming down, so I was just trying to put myself in positions. I didn't make a birdie the last few holes and missed by one. So that's the kind of thing in pro golf that can drive you nuts if you harp on it too much. That's just kind of the way it goes. You know, it's easy to think about the shots that I could have gotten those last four holes, but over 72 holes, there's way more than a shot and you can get back anywhere. So just kind of learning from the experience. I'm happy my first time there. I played a decent golf tournament and, you know, we're looking forward to the season.
Yeah. I mean, I imagine as a guy, I mean, you're still a pretty young guy. You only out of college golf. What, this was your second year out of college golf? Do I have that right?
Yes.
It's much different to miss that next status by one stroke than a guy kind of who's been at this for 20 years, who maybe his career is headed in a little bit different direction, where you got everything still headed in the right direction. Yeah. So I didn't watch as much of it as I wanted to, you know, just chasing around kids and stuff like that. But the weather of the tournament looked like it was totally insane. That caused some big scores the first couple of days, right? Thursday, Friday.
It did. And I think this week was one. So it was on two different golf courses, just because of how big the field was. They couldn't pack us all into one golf course. We played at Sawgrass Country Club and Dyes Valley at TPC Sawgrass. Both courses incredibly tight and frankly very challenging. But Dyes Valley is a little more protected. So very, very windy at Sawgrass Country Club. You know, we're only 100 yards or so off the beach. And it was blowing about 30 miles an hour the first round. So it was buckle down, you know, try to make pars where you can and just not force anything. There were a lot of high scores and it wouldn't take much to shoot something, you know, an uncharacteristically high score for any of those guys. So it was a grind, which is what you want at an event like that. You know, when the conditions are easy, they would have taken 25 under to get there. So it's nice to level the playing field a little bit, have a bit of a grind, but it took a lot of mental fortitude to go out there and accept that, you know, some things are out of your control and some golf shots that feel pretty good are going to end up in pretty bad spots.
Do you, being only kind of your second year out of playing college golf, trying to make it as a professional golfer, do you have good relationships with many other guys that were in Q school? You mentioned Hayden Springer that you knew from the PGA mm-hmm. Tour Canada, but like, you know, did guys that have been at this 5, 10, 15 times, you know, give you any pointers on how to handle Q school?
You know, I've talked to guys beforehand. You know, I've been fortunate to be around a lot of good golfers for a long time, so I've always done what I can to pick their brains. But as far as during the tournament week, everybody's kind of in their own little world. Obviously, you know, we have friends, we do dinner, we do all that stuff. But as far as being on the golf course, trying to pick somebody's brain, that's not really the time or place for it. So, you know, I have a caddy who had a lot of experience, so I was kind of working with him, leaning heavily on him. But, you know, it's not a time to get in anybody's head about what you should be doing. You know, they're all trying to focus on themselves.
Sure. So I want to go back to your season here. So over the summer, you won your first tournament, the ATB Classic.
That's right.
in late July, mm-hmm. that weekend, late July or late June, early July. But so you won that as a Monday qualifier, which is incredibly impressive. What, going into that tournament, what was like, what kind of status did you have? Were you playing a lot of tournaments on PGA Tour Canada, or was that, walk me through that?
No. So, I'll back up just a little bit. My first year as a pro, first full year as a pro, I turned pro in October of 21. So I got through Q school for PGA Tour Canada in March of 22.
Okay.
You know, obviously my first time having status of professional tour, didn't really know what to expect. I had a okay college career, but I knew my game was improving. I knew I was ready to compete at a higher level. And I went out there and I made seven out of nine cuts, and lost my card. And I was kind of like, whoa, what is going on here? Something had to switch. And in that off season, you know, I kind of started struggling my game a little bit. Swing was a little bit off for quite a while, basically from Thanksgiving of last year to May. I developed some backswing hitch that I just couldn't get rid of. So it was a tough kind of dark off season, not what you were looking for. And things started to improve a little bit. I played just well enough at Q school to get conditional status. I wasn't going to get any starts guaranteed, but that's good enough because you can go play Mondays. And if you play well, then you'll get the rest of the season, so on and so forth. So I skipped the first two Canada events just because they were both way out west and I had to go for a Monday, and it just didn't feel like the best use of my time to go out to Victoria, Canada for one round of golf if it didn't go well. So I took the two off, played some mini tour stuff, and my game was improving a little bit, and I wasn't sure if I was going to go to Canada. You know, everyone kept asking me. It's like, I don't really know. You know, I think I might be better off just playing Mondays, trying to bully my way into the Corn Ferry that way. And then I was at a G-Pro in a G-Pro is a minor league, a mini tour in North Carolina, Southeast.
Yep.
And I was playing good golf, and I, you know, hit a ton of greens in the first round, didn't make anything, shot one under, and then the tournament got canceled for rain. And I was just distraught. And I was like, I need something to play in. And that next week was the Edmonton event, and the Monday qualifier was probably a week from when I was playing that tournament in North Carolina. And I said, all right, screw it. Let's go. Let's go play on Monday. Let's try to get the season going a little bit. I knew my game was trending in the right direction. I wouldn't say I was like playing the best golf of my life, ready to go win a golf tournament by any means. But I went up there, you know, fully intending on Monday qualifying and playing well enough to just get the rest of the season. That was my main goal. So I went up, played okay in the Monday, got through, was very happy about it. And then, you know, got some really good work in, made some serious improvements just in the first couple of days before the tournament, the Tuesday and Wednesday. And I was like, you know what, I'm starting to feel pretty good. And I went out, started on the back the first round late. Conditions were super benign. You know, we were like playing in a dome at elevation, so the ball's going a mile. It was just a lot of fun. I chipped in on my first hole for eagle, made a couple more birdies, then holed a wedge shot on my seventh hole for eagle. So I was six under through seven. And it was all of a sudden like, all right, here we go. Like, I think we're going to be comfortably make the cut here. We got the rest of the season. Let's play golf. And then from that point on, it was just a good tournament. I was kind of firing on just about all cylinders. Conditions got really, really tough on the weekend after the first 2 days being about as easy as they get. And I was ready for that. You know, I think one part of my game that's always been very good is being able to kind of handle elements and play ugly golf, because a lot of guys have a tough time when it's not, you know, basically TrackMan golf. So went in there and played two good last rounds, played a great back nine on Sunday, and walked away with the trophy. And that really just got the whole rest of the year in motion.
And that's awesome. And you didn't waste any time. You came back. When was the Quebec Open? That was the very next week, or?
So we had a week off after Edmonton. And, you know, I was just so thrilled to, A, win a big golf tournament like that, and B, have status for the rest of the year. And I guaranteed full status for PGA Tour Americas next year. So it was all good stuff. You know, I took 3 days of basically celebrating with my friends, just like so happy that things had gone well. And then, you know, got back into it a little bit, started playing again, probably the Thursday before the next tournament week. Was still playing good golf. Went up to Montreal, was the next week. Dumped rain on the drive up there. The course was closed for 2 days. We couldn't use the driving range, so I only got one practice round in. Didn't hit a lot of balls, and it was just like, all right, it's, you know, it's go time. And that week was more of a kind of blackout. I came to on Sunday when we were doing the trophy presentation on the green. You know, it was, you know, once you see yourself do it once, you win in that kind of arena, it kind of, you feel like you unlock something. So that was a great week. Just made a ton of birdies. Everybody was chasing, and I was lucky to come out on top at the end. So that second win really sealed, at the very worst, top five for the year, which I was thrilled about. Because I knew at very worst I'd be at final stage with a chance to improve and to move into the next year. And, you know, obviously we did a little better and got some guaranteed starts.
So you, can you put your finger on what kind of changed in your game or your swing from kind of the winter where you said you developed some kind of hitch in your backswing versus, you know, winning back to back? And how much, my follow-up question to that, I understand you've been working for a long time with a former guest on this podcast, Mr. John Scott Rattan. Did he play a role in that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I'll admit, and John Scott would back this up, that I'm not always the easiest guy to coach. You know, this was a problem that I had developed 2 years prior, and it took us about 4 months to fix it. And it popped back up again. And for some reason, it was just as difficult. So John Scott stuck with me, and I have another coach in Florida, Jason Bale. And we all were just, well, I was banging my head against the wall. They were obviously very calm and supportive. But we threw everything at the wall until something finally stuck, and it did. So the swing was a big part of it, but I think I have to give a lot of the credit also to a mental coach that I've been working with for a few years now. His name's Graham Betchart. And I think the biggest thing that Graham taught me is that you don't need what you think is your best stuff to play well. And he's not a golf. He's not, his background's mostly in basketball. I was one of the first golfers he's ever worked with. So we're working on a much higher level stuff than just, oh, how do you avoid hitting at the water? How do I go out and play well when I'm not feeling good? So on. It's much more about, how do I prepare? How do I think? How do I approach the game? So it just came to a point where I said, Graham, I'm ready to win a golf tournament. I don't care what it has to feel like or look like. Like, it's time to do this. And he agreed. And we just took that mindset into the week. You know, no one has their perfect stuff every week. If you do once a year, you're lucky. And that's, you know, maybe you're lucky to get it once every 3 years. So it's a matter of managing misses. It's a matter of managing your temper. And if you can stick with it for 72 holes and be committed for that long, then good things happen, no matter really how bad you feel like you're playing.
That's interesting. So how long have you been working with Graham?
Graham and I started just pretty much right when I turned pro. So December of 21.
And how did you find him?
I went to school at Notre Dame, and I did a fifth year at a school called FAU down in Boca, as a grad student, just playing for my COVID eligibility. He started at Stanford, and Graham is located in San Francisco. And I had a mental coach at the time that I was happy with. I didn't really understand how important it could be to find somebody that you really click with. And he showed me his stuff, and Graham's a beautiful mind, I'll say. He makes songs to kind of illustrate his points. You know, he's very eccentric, but he's the best mental coach I've ever worked with before. And he showed me his stuff when we were there, and it's pretty interesting. And then I kind of forgot about it for a year, and I was looking for somebody in December. I was like, Coach, well, who was that guy you showed us that one time? He's like, oh, it's Graham. Here's his number. Shoot him a text. And we did, and we had 1 hour session in to start, just to introduce, and I was sold immediately. I think it's really important to find somebody that not only you trust what he's saying, you trust that he knows what he's talking about, but will be open to kind of more of a conversational type approach. I think one thing that I've found with a lot of golf specific mental coaches is that it almost turns into them reading their books to you, which a lot of these guys have nothing but incredible wisdom in their books, but it's not personalized in the way that I would have liked it. And with Graham, you know, we don't have a schedule for our calls. We don't have a plan of what we're working on. It's kind of day in and day out. What are you feeling today? What are you feeling? And I'm very open with him. I tell him, man, Graham, I feel like I'm going to shoot 100 today. Like, and that's honestly how it is sometimes. And he's able to work around those feelings, see where they're coming from and how we can kind of fight back against them. So Graham's been pivotal in any success that I've had, and I'm not letting him go anytime soon. That's for sure.
That's great to hear. Have you found, just your experience interacting with all other players, you know, on the PGA Tour Canada and otherwise, is everybody using a mental coach these days? Is it a pretty high percentage, or how many do you think? What percentage?
You know, it's not necessarily something you go and talk about that much. I would say it's around 75%. It's high. Certainly more guys than not. I've gotten Graham connected with a couple of my friends down here and in the pro world that I think could benefit from him and would gel with his personality, because he's certainly not for everybody. I personally think it's the most important thing you can do when you're golf game. I mean, assuming you have the physical skills, the tangible skills to hit the golf shots you need to compete. Once you get to that point where you can do that, it almost doesn't matter. It's how well can you manage your emotions? How well can you plan? How well can you stay in the moment when the lights get bright?
Sure. Can you paint a picture a little bit? I mean, you've mentioned you got a mental coach, you've got two swing coaches. People follow PGA Tour players and they see these huge entourages of their whole teams that travel them from tour stop to tour stop. Can you paint a little bit of a picture of what it's like on PGA Tour Canada, as far as, I don't know about your coach in Florida, but I know John Scott, he's got a whole stable of people he's coaching. I'm sure able to follow you to tournament to tournament. I'm sure a lot of this has to be done remote or when you're in town. Who are you traveling with? What is the travel like? In my head, I'm picturing, I'm sure it's a step up from Motel Sixes and, you know, eating in, you know, in buffets, but I don't know. You tell me.
It's a step up, but it's not a big step up. So travel in, you know, Canada, it's a great opportunity. It's a part of the process. You know, most guys have to get through one of those tours to improve. But in no way is it a glorious life up there. You know, for the most part, we're playing pretty far outside of cities, kind of in the middle of nowhere. Like when I was in Montreal, I stayed in an Airbnb that was above a dermatology office in a town that had maybe 8 buildings, 1 restaurant. So I ate there most nights and cooked other nights. So it's not as glorious as the life you see on the PGA Tour. Obviously, I've never had a coach or anybody come up with me up there, never a caddy. You get local caddies every week, which are generally just members that want to watch golf. That'll be a little bit different next year. There are a couple events that coaches will be at that's a little more accessible. You know, we play in Florida, we play in the Southeast a little bit. But as far as Canada goes, it's a lot of staying with other players. It's a lot of cheap meals and it's a lot of downtime.
What is the local caddies, you know, so both of those wins, you had like a local caddy who was a member at the turn, and did they help? Did they just try to stay out of the way? Did any incidents?
No incidents. I was lucky this year. I've had incidents in the past that we'll just leave it at that. but I think when you are on a tour like that, you know, you're just texting a caddy master, hey, I need a guy starting Wednesday. And they'll say, if they can get one, if you do it early enough, you know, usually they only have enough caddies for about half the field. And you are allowed to carry your own bag in Canada. I think the best caddies that I had up there understood that in the nicest way possible, they don't have much to contribute from a golf standpoint. My caddy in Edmonton, Don, since I Monday qualified, I got him late. I didn't meet him until about 10 minutes before my tee time on the first round. He was an awesome guy, super fun to be around, and really just happy to be there. I mean, he was from that first nine all the way through. He was absolutely glowing. So it was fun to share that with him. He did a great job. He kept up. I mean, with the cliche about caddies is show up, shut up, and keep up. And they did a good job with all of those. My caddy in Montreal spoke very little English. So, you know, we conversed how we had to, but I don't speak any French. So there's a little bit of a language barrier there, but he also did a great job. So, it's fun. I think it's a lot of things in Canada. You have to understand that you're not on the PGA Tour. Life's a little bit different. You know, the tour does everything they can to make it as high level as they can. Budget's relatively low. So, you know, we were lucky to have chiropractors and physios on site. Every once in a while, we'd get meals at the course from the tournament. But other than that, it was kind of, here's your scorecard. We'll see you after your round.
Yeah. So what about like on a tour like that, where there's so much downtime, you know, there's not a lot of glitz and glamour. Are there many locals even coming out to watch? Are there anybody watching the tournaments other than friends and family?
Yeah, it depends on the week. I would say there were like Edmonton and Montreal. We probably had 100 or so people following the final group in both of those rounds. And then, you know, as far as build out goes, they put one or two grandstands and kind of VIP areas on the 18th green. So those get pretty busy on a Friday morning when you're teeing off the back at 10 a.m. No, you're not going to see anybody for quite some time.
Is there much camaraderie amongst the players that are playing, or is it somewhat cutthroat and you're not socializing too much?
There's a lot of camaraderie. Like I said, we're all kind of in the same boat. Everybody wants everybody to succeed. Obviously, obviously you want to do the best. But there's a lot. I mean, we're playing practice rounds together, getting dinner together, traveling together, staying together, all that stuff. It's costs are high up there and pay is low. So you got to kind of manage that as well as you can. And a lot of that comes down to, you know, driving guys to different tournaments, staying together, you know, four or five people to an Airbnb, getting dinner together, cooking, all that stuff. So the camaraderie is one of the best parts about that tour, I would say.
So, and some of this I'm just learning. So going forward, because this past year, PGA Tour Canada and PGA Tour Latin America were two different things, correct?
Yes.
And this year, they're merging them. So it's like 16 events. Some of them will be in Canada. Some will be in south of the border. And essentially, that's officially the tour just below Korn Ferry.
Correct.
So going forward in 2024, you said you've got, like, how do you envision your 2024 looking? You said you've got four guaranteed starts on Korn Ferry. How does the rest of the year play out for you?
So let's say I go to those first four events and I play well, if I make two of the cuts, let's say, then I'm guaranteed the rest of the season. So I'll play all 26 on Korn Ferry. Should those first four not go well, I'd still be a conditional member. I would likely get a couple more starts the rest of the year and be able to improve my status. But with Korn Ferry status, I'm also exempt onto the PGA Tour Americas. So if it comes to that, I could go and play basically a full schedule up in Latin America and Canada.
Got it. And doing that, obviously that's not the plan, but doing that would just ensure that you're at a certain stage of Q school next year to do this all over again.
I have to play well. It's top 25, go to second stage, top five still from America's go to finals.
Okay.
So my best path to status is just playing well those first four, you know, keep my card or move up the PGA Tour through Korn Ferry. But you never know. So I'm ready for anything. Yeah. I'll have somewhere to play all year. And I know that that's comforting.
That's good. And so is those four are literally the first four Korn Ferry events of on the calendar?
Yes.
Oh, that's good. I don't know the Korn Ferry schedule like I should. When does that get started?
So we start in January 14th. The first two events are in the Bahamas. First one is at Exuma at Sandals. Second one is Abaco, in Grand Bahama, Abaco Club. And then we go down to Panama and then Bogota and then Argentina and Chile. So the first six are all international. And then the last 20 are all around the U.S., kind of from as far west as Portland to as far east as Savannah to New Jersey, kind of in that range.
Got it. So that's a quick turnaround. Just a couple of weeks, you're down to the Bahamas getting after it.
Yeah.
So I'm not the biggest gear guy in the world, but I figured, anytime I got a professional golfer on here, I should do a what's in the bag. Like what kind of clubs you hitting?
I'm Titleist 14 clubs. Proudly, I just got my first Circle T Scotty Cameron a couple of weeks ago. So I'm very excited about that. Do you want me to go through the whole bag?
Sure. Why not? I'm sure some listeners will love it.
Cool. Yeah. So, I got them right behind me here. So I play the Titleist TSR 3 driver.
Okay.
The Tensei White Shaft. I've got the TSR 2 3 wood and TSR 2 5 wood. I've got a U500 3 iron with the ATM, staffed Project X. I've got, Titleist T100s 4 iron through pitching wedge with, Project X 6.5s, 52 degree Vokey, F grind, 10 degrees of bounce. 58 degree Vokey, bounce between 4 and 8 degrees of bounce. And I was using the Terillium Newport Scotty Cameron, and I'm just switched to a Golo. So we're seeing if I can make a few more putts. But all the way Titleist through the bag. And then I play the Pro V1, 2023 Pro V1.
How often are you kind of tweaking what's in your bag and especially like your wedges and putter?
Very rarely. I think the last few iterations of woods for Titleist have gone right in the bag. They've just been, you know, Titleist does a very good job of keeping their same kind of character with just minor improvements. Irons I'll do every couple of years, not always to the new model. Cause I think with irons, it's more important to have something that you're comfortable with and know the flight of than it is the newest technology. So I'm still playing the 2021 T100. Try to get a new 58 degree every month or so. And then putter is sort of an as needed basis. Sometimes a putter cannot cooperate for a little while and it's time to put her in timeout. So that's where I'm at right now. There's a new putter in the bag as of yesterday. But as far as the other 13 clubs go, I've played the same setup for quite a while now.
At what point as a professional golfer, or is it as a college golfer? I don't even know. Do like what's in your bag playing 14 Titleist? Is that because you prefer Titleist? I mean, obviously you prefer Titleist, but like, do you become an official Titleist guy, like where you're contractually hitting Titleist?
Yep. So I was under a ball shoe glove contract with Titleist the last 2 years. That's pretty standard satellite tour deal.
Okay.
And then I was paying for golf clubs, which I thought was standard, but apparently is not. I was lucky to sign an agent after those couple of wins to kind of manage everything that's going on. And he was able to get a contract signed where I'm, you know, on staff with them. I have a full line deal, some bonuses in place. So I'm fortunate that I've played Titleist anyway. And they wanted to bring me on staff. A lot of guys, when they get to this point, start looking around different options, but I've loved Titleist for a long time and I'm just happy that they're supporting me.
Very cool. So you mentioned earlier on that, I haven't looked up all your college stats at Notre Dame, but I know you're a good golfer. You described it as an okay college career. I doubt that's accurate. But when you said you did 1 year kind of on COVID eligibility as a grad student at FAU, you know, was there any kind of what was the decision process like about whether or not to give professional golf a go? Was there any doubt?
It was. I unfortunately played some of the worst golf of my life that year at FAU, and it was during COVID, and you know, I was still doing school. It was not the best 6 months of my life, that's for sure. And during that time, like I said, I developed some swing issues that refused to go away, and it was, you know, April of that year of 2021. And I was like, dude, like I'm finishing school in a month and either you're going to turn pro or you're not. So it's time. And I had a lot of conversations with my parents, with John Scott, and was like, you know, am I going to do this? Are we ready for this? And my parents said, absolutely. Like, this is all what you've always wanted to do. You're going to figure it out. You're going to do well. I wasn't as confident as they were, but I knew if I kind of managed the swing like I knew I could and got it back to a place where I could play good golf, that I had what it took. I think one thing that I took a lot of comfort in is that pretty much my entire life, save maybe that 6 months, I've improved every year. I've gotten a little bit better every year. And I was never a world beater as a junior. I had an okay to solid college career. And I never won, but I was kind of a lot of top 10s. I was kind of a top 10 guy in college, which is fine. But every year I felt like I learned something. I kind of gained some knowledge and got a little bit better. And I just figured if I keep improving at this rate over time, it's just good things are going to happen. So I was confident in that, even though the results weren't necessarily there at the time that I did turn pro. And I was just lucky to have a great support system behind me to be able to do it, because it's not an easy endeavor to undertake from the get-go.
Sure, I imagine. Well, let's keep rewinding. So now let's get to a part of the reason why you're on the Beltway Golfer podcast is you're a DMV guy. You grew up around Washington, D.C. So a couple things. So one, you played golf at Georgetown Prep.
That's right.
You say you weren't a world beater in high school. Everything's relative. I mean, I got you as
relative.
You were all met three times. Do I have that right? Including as a senior, you were player of the year.
I was player of the year senior year. I know that for sure. I was never first team all met. And to be honest with you, I can't remember how deep that all met selection actually went, but I was probably an honorable mention a couple of times.
Okay.
I played fine for most of high school. I had some good finishes, and then senior year I won IACs and Metros, and that was, you know, good. But it's funny because, like I said, I wasn't a world beater. So high school golf, no matter where you are, is kind of a little bit of a bubble, right? There's a funny story I'll share about college. So to fast forward a little bit while we rewind, we were in school, and it was probably eight or nine guys on the golf team at Notre Dame just in our locker room hanging out, and our coach brought his a recruit in who was in high school. I don't know where he was from. And I guess this kid was kind of being a little brash and a little, you know, bragging a little bit to coach in a way that he was like, okay, this kid needs to kind of see what he's walking into here. And coach walks in and said, hey, guys, I don't remember his name. Johnny here just won his high school state championship. He's very proud of it. We're all like, oh, good job. And he's like, how many of you guys won your state championship? And everybody in the room's hand went up. So, you know, success at the high school level only kind of puts you at the same level as everybody else you're going to once you get to a national level. So that's kind of more what I mean. I wasn't, you know, competing very well on a national stage, but I was, you know, always kind of in the mix in my local area.
That's what's so unique about golf being at that level, it's a team sport, but you get individual honors and winning an individual. Mm-hmm. So everyone, you have a Division I team that's just every single person has won enough titles to make them think that they are a world beater until they get to that next level and they realize everyone's done it because everyone's, you know, it's a singular trophy. So also from around here, so were you still in high school and you won a Maryland Open, correct? Was that when you were at?
I was in college. That was 2019.
Okay.
So I was going into my senior year of college.
And do I have it? Are you somewhere? I read that you're a congressional guy. Is that how you met John Scott?
Right. No. So when I started with John Scott, it was about a week or 2 weeks before he came over to congressional. But he was at Bethesda Country Club at the time. And my couple of my good friends, Chris and Joey Lane, had started seeing him. Evan Katz, who you likely know, he was seeing him mm-hmm. for a long time. And I wasn't thrilled with the instruction that I was getting at the time. And I think it was time for a change. And I went over there and met with him. And very, very soon after, he ended up on the back of the range at congressional. So it worked out really well.
Do you come from a family of golfers? When did you start picking up a club?
I come from a family of casual golfers. You know, my dad's an eight. I'm sure he'll listen to that. So I'm sorry, Dad. He definitely instilled in me the love of the game. But not much else. So to answer your question, I had a club in my hand when I was 3 years old. You know, I'd go out with him, plastic clubs, just messing around, and I really enjoyed it. I don't know what exactly it was, but from that moment on, it was, it's pretty much all I've thought about every day of my life for the last 23 years. You know, I was fortunate to grow up with a good group of kids my age. We had about 7 of us that ended up playing in college and played every day. And so we were always kind of pushing each other and getting better and better. And that's very fortunate, especially in that area. You know, it's not, golf isn't as popular as other sports. You know, obviously lacrosse and basketball and football are the big ones in the DC area. So to have a good close knit group of guys that I could play with every day and we all improved was a massive, massive contributor to my success.
When did you start playing competitive junior golf? How old?
So it was kind of, I started slowly. I did a lot of junior golf at Congressional. I want to give a shout out to Stacy Miller Arndt. She was probably the number one supporter of my golf career from a very, very young age. Taught me everything that I know about how to, you know, keep a scorecard and organize my clubs, the real basic stuff. I started playing kind of MAPGA stuff, Plantation Tour stuff around probably 13, 14, and then just gradually expanded where I would play. Started going to North Carolina a little bit. Went to Florida for the first time for a golf tournament when I was 16 or so. And just kind of, it started growing and growing, and then started playing AJGAs, which are obviously national events. Played out of the country a couple of times. So it just started growing over time.
Do you remember a time when it really kind of started clicking for you, where you thought that this, you know, at the very least could be something you do in college?
There wasn't necessarily one big moment. I remember the first time that I ever broke par in a golf tournament. It was at Reston National. I don't know what year it was. But I went out and I shot, I think, 39 on the front. I want to say it was a par 71. And I turned around on the back and shot 31, birdied my last hole. And it was like I blacked out. I'd never experienced a feeling that before. And I was like, oh my God, that was awesome. That was so much fun. Like, what just happened? And I didn't have the, obviously, mental skills to be able to analyze, like, oh, that's what flow feels like. Yeah, you can kind sure. of force that a little bit. That was way too early for that. But that was when I was like, huh, maybe I am, you know, okay at this. Maybe I'm actually pretty good at this.
How old do you think you were?
I know my dad drove me to the tournament, so I was, you know, younger than 15. I was probably 13 or 14 if I had to guess.
Wow. Nice.
But it was just always something that even though the results weren't necessarily there, I was like, I think I could actually be good at this. I felt like I had, from a young age, so much more in the tank that I was just slowly kind of tapping into. And like I said, with the improvement every year was just a couple more experiences that I found that I was more prepared for than I thought I would be, and so on. It just kind of grew and grew from there.
I got to ask, Andrew Green's renovation at Congressional. What are your thoughts?
I think it's a lot of fun. It's a brand new golf course compared to what it used to be. I'll say I was a huge, huge fan of the old one. I think it was the traditional classic Northeastern golf course, but there were a lot of issues that course had that were a result of the design. So namely too much tree cover, a lot of big slopes around the greens that funneled water into the greens. The course was never as healthy as it should be for, you know, such a, premier club. So I think now with no trees, the course is far and away the healthiest I've ever seen it on a day-to-day basis. And it's just a unique golf course. You know, it's weird going out to a course that is fundamentally the same course that you grew up on. You know, I used to know it like the back of my hand, to now it's a brand new golf course. Like, it has the character, it still has the same routing, but I've played it probably a dozen times now, and I'm still every time learning, and I still see a pin on the green and couldn't tell you exactly where it is. So it's a learning curve, but I think it's a great golf course, and I'm excited to see it, you know, put up to the test against the best golfers in the world soon.
Not to put the cart ahead of the horse, but you've played it 12 times since renovation. Do you, the PGA Championship's coming to Congressional in, was it 2028?
30.
So you got 7 years. I mean, is that in the back of your head a little bit?
Sure. You know, I would be thrilled to be able to play a major at my home course. I think that's a very unique opportunity that 99% of professional golfers never get a chance to do. But that being said, I think I'm more worried about the first 4 events in the Korn Ferry Tour this year.
Sure.
So I think that would be an absolutely incredible opportunity. And when we get there, we'll see how it happens.
So in the more of the present, you know, when you look at 2024, I mean, you covered kind of what your year looks like, but your goals, like what is a good 2024 result look like for you?
You know, it's always interesting setting goals in golf, because if I play good golf for me, I will be on the PGA Tour in 2025, right? So it's hard to say anything other than, oh, my goal is to be on the PGA Tour in 2025. So that's obviously number one, the goal. Let's go out there, not worry about conditional status with that. Let's just go play good golf. Everything takes care of itself. If that's, you know, top of the mountain goal number one, I think the biggest goal for me would be to gain the full season, be able to play 26 events on the Korn Ferry Tour, and then keep my card for next year. Be able to go to Q School final stage next year, full status guaranteed, and be able to play for that top five with, you know, nothing else in the back of my mind.
Couple questions kind of just more related to, you know, there's a couple big things going on in golf. Is there a lot of chatter? I mean, obviously you're so focused on Q School and you're focused on your 2024 and going to the next level, but there's been a lot of big topics in golf these days. Is, you know, what is the chatter at your level? You guys talk about like the golf ball rollback, for instance. Is that something that you guys talk about at the range or in the locker rooms? And what's the general feeling of players?
A little bit. I think the rollback is interesting because I'll admit that I haven't done a lot of research into what it actually means. There's a lot of information going around. Like, I saw a tweet the other day that Keegan Bradley was hitting the proposed rollback golf ball and it was going 50 yards shorter. It's like, okay, is that really? I highly doubt that's what this rollback means. From what I've heard about it, it just sounds like they're trying to make it go 10 to 15% shorter. Whatever that means. I think it'll be interesting to see how that plays out at different club speeds, because there's a very real chance that relative to the field, the long guys get longer and the short guys get shorter based on the compression of the golf ball. That's entirely possible. And it also could tighten the pack up. I think, in my opinion, the best way for a rollback to happen would be smaller driver heads for sure. I think if we go back to a 430cc driver head, that's a way better way to kind of bring skill back into the driving of the golf ball. I don't think distance is the only issue. I think forgiveness is the issue. And I think if I were to propose a rolled back golf ball, it would be higher spin, and more susceptible to curve than it would be just going shorter. You know, old golf balls like the professional 90, you could get that thing going 60 yards left or right if you hit it off center. And the modern golf watch doesn't do that. I mean, between head technology and ball technology, I could hit one clean off the toe of the driver and it would just be a tight draw down the middle. Right. So that's kind of more so what I look at it from. I don't see it as a distance issue so much as there's not enough of a penalty for miss hits. So I would like to see a ball that curves more and a head that's less forgiving before I'd like to see just a golf ball that's like a marshmallow, you know?
I would imagine the rollback doesn't necessarily impact how golfers – it doesn't necessarily improve or harden anybody's path to getting to the tour or becoming a professional golfer, because it impacts everybody. Maybe it helps a shorter golfer a little bit more than somebody that just bombs it. But one topic that I think might impact someone's path is just the larger thing that's going on in professional golf, which is, you know, the battle between PGA Tour and LIV, and how PGA Tour has responded by these elevated events and really focusing on the top, whatever it is, I don't even know, 25, 50 golfers and increasing purses, making it maybe a little bit challenger for that, a little more challenging for golfers in that second, third, or fourth tier to really make as much of a living as they used to. Is that something that's discussed? Does that weigh at all on golfers that on these smaller tours as whether or not they can have a future in golf?
A little bit. I think, you know, everybody on these tours firmly believes that they can be a top 50 golfer in the world. And if you didn't, I don't know why you would necessarily even play. But it's interesting. Obviously, there's been a lot of different news coming out from the tour and from LIV and what's happening and what they're trying to do, who they're trying to take care of. And I think at the base of it, I think it's easy to think of every, let's say there are 200 guys in the PGA Tour, give or take. It's easy to be like, oh, we all are on the same tour. We deserve the same compensation, the same, you know, access, the same publicity. And that's just not the case, right? I mean, any league in the world, it relies heavily, heavily on their stars, be that the top 5%, 10% of whatever league or tour that there is. So I understand the tour's move to compensate those guys better, give them better opportunity to market themselves, to earn more money. But at the same time, I think there's a way to do it without leaving the last 150 guys in the dust. And that's the sentiment that a lot of those guys have. They feel like they're not being heard. And the majority of them, almost all of them, I would say, frankly, all of them understand that Rory McIlroy moves the needle. He deserves, he's who brings the fans. He is who is generating the majority of the revenue for the tour. But at the same time, the tour is built around, you know, 156 person field where pretty much anybody can win on a given week. And, they need to be compensated the same way and they have the same opportunities if they play good golf. So I think it might take a couple of years for the tour to find the structure that really works where, you know, you're going to be in a category where you're not in the elevated events, but there's going to be a path, a very clear path of how you can get into those. And if you play good golf, you will be in the elevated events. There's nothing they do to keep you out of it. It's not like they're saying the top 50 from last year, that's the tour now. Everybody else right. go back to Korn Ferry and try to get in that top 50. No, it's, you're on tour. You're playing different events. There's frankly two tours on the PGA Tour now with the elevated events and the regular events. But as long as there's a clear path for guys to go from that regular tour event circuit to the elevated events, then I think people will be understanding and happy with it.
You said you moved down to Jupiter, you said last year, 2 years ago?
2 years ago.
It's, you know, when you go out to a restaurant in Jupiter, are there just golfers everywhere? That's kind of what I imagine.
It's a lot of golfers. I'd say there are more retirees than there are golfers in any given restaurant, depending on what time you go. But there are a few places, you know, if you go to Thousand North, Jordan's place, there's always, you know, you name it there, Brooks, DJ, all those really? Guys are hanging out. The places that I go to eat, you know, it's more guys like me, you know, it's all income based, right? But it's cool. It's a very golf focused, city. I mean, I live on Donald Ross Boulevard and it's just a normal street in the city. Every light you turn on, there's a golf course to your left, to your right. People drive around in golf carts. So it's a very, very golf and pickleball now focused city.
Right. What about last question for you here? What, I'm always curious, especially, you know, having a podcast myself, when you're on the range, what are you listening to, whether it be music or, any golf podcast you listen to?
It depends. I can't say I listen to a lot of golf podcasts because I get enough golf my whole life. So once I leave the golf course, I'll listen to pretty much anything else.
Or not. What about non-golf podcasts?
Yeah. So I spend a lot of time on the road. I'd say in season, not so much on Korn Ferry, but between Canada and mini tours, I'm spending at least 16 hours on the road a week. So what I've found is I try to, every third podcast I'm listening to on the road has to be something at least somewhat educational. You know, there's a lot of very interesting podcasts about literally anything you could ever want to learn about out there.
That's good policy.
But 75% of the time, it's just comedy podcasts, drivel. It's just something that I can kind of have in the background, tune out, and sure. just try to get to the destination. So when I'm on the golf course, I don't listen to music when I hit balls most of the time. If I'm putting, although it's always music, it'll be anywhere from, you know, Lil Wayne to Vivaldi. It really just depends on how I'm feeling that day and what I'm trying to get done. So I, you know, I'm not like everybody else, not like a lot of guys who, you know, have headphones in 100% of the time when they're practicing. I like it sometimes, but a lot of times I just, you know, I think I learn a lot from the sound the golf ball makes, be that putting, chipping, hitting balls. So I get more from hearing that, the audio of the golf shot, than I do kind of whatever's in the headphones.
Well, that's great. It's always good insight to kind of hear what the life of a professional golfer, especially someone that's trying to move stage to stage. So on that note, man, I really appreciate you you taking time on such short notice after such a huge event and week at Q School. Congratulations on the awesome year and best of luck coming up here just in a couple of weeks, man. This is gonna be an exciting year for you.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
I don't have a good golf game, but I don't really care. I'm a regular dude living in D.C., and I want to know about D.C.-centric golf stuff. If you can tell me something that I don't already know, then that is great for me. I don't want the regular stuff. I want exciting stuff. I want different stuff. I want stuff I can't hear elsewhere. But I want it to be about D.C. golf.